This podcast is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. What if a dating app for cows could help kids get better grades? And imagine if a high-tech toilet could raise attendance in schools. When you get the right partners together, the potential is endless. Find out more at gatesfoundation.org/potential. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, partners of human potential.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the president's son, a music producer, a lawyer from Moscow, the Miss Universe pageant, and now the promise of help from the Russian government, connecting the dots on Donald Trump Jr.'s communications last summer. And the longest war in the Americas is coming to an end. What happens when thousands of rebel fighters try to re-enter society as civilians? It's Tuesday, July 11th.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Hey, good.
Mark Mazzetti, you've been reporting with our colleagues on this meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer. What's the latest that we know about that meeting?
The latest is that there's an email exchange with Donald Trump Jr. Mm-hmm. that is setting up this meeting, which happened in June 2016. And in the email, there's one email that indicates that the meeting was set up on the promise that the Russian government had damaging information about Hillary Clinton. So what we've known before, which Donald Trump Jr. admitted to on Sunday, was that the meeting was to get some kind of damaging information about Clinton. The significance here is that they seemed to be willing to do this meeting because there seemed to be a Russian government promise of information, which raises the stakes.
So let me just make sure I understand this. As Donald Trump Jr. prepared for this meeting with a Russian lawyer, his understanding of the source of the information that she might be bearing about Hillary Clinton was that it was from the Russian government.
Yes, Russian officials, the Russian government, that it was not private information that had been obtained mm-hmm. by this individual or other Russians.
And Mark, what evidence do we have of this? What's in the emails?
We have spoken to a number of people who know the contents of the email mm-hmm. Or have been described. The email's been described to them. And so we feel very comfortable about reporting what the gist of the email was. Mm-hmm. And again, the significance is that it was certainly conveyed to the Trump campaign that there was Russian government material here.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that you may or may not be literally allowed to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Who sent the email?
Well, so the email was sent by Rob Goldstone, who is in the music industry. His client is someone named Emin Agalarov, who is a pop singer in Russia.
Wow.
Emin Agalarov's father, Aris, is in the real estate industry in Russia and knows Donald Trump from the 2013 Miss Universe pageant that Donald Trump held in Moscow. You can
keep the lights on. So we're talking about here about maybe somewhat characteristically with Donald Trump, real estate, beauty pageants, and money.
Correct. And Trump and Emin Agalarov, the son, appeared in a music video together several years ago
Wow. Promoting
the event.
Emin, let's get with it. You're always late. You're just another pretty face. I'm really tired of you. You're fired.
So there is obviously a past tie there between the Trump family and the Agalarov family. And so the conduit here, Rob Goldstone, who we believe Donald Trump Jr. knows from that period of time, Goldstone becomes the conduit for the 2016 meeting.
Okay, and one more dot to connect here. How does this music producer know this Russian lawyer?
That's still a little bit unclear.
Okay.
This lawyer is certainly someone who is well-known in Moscow. She is connected to at least the Kremlin, and her the interest she advances in lobbying and lawsuits in the United States are in line with those of the Kremlin.
Got it.
So she is a certainly well-known individual to the U.S. government, but also back in Moscow as well.
So, Mark, in these emails, Goldstone is arranging for Donald Trump Jr. to meet with this Russian lawyer and suggesting she has information on Hillary Clinton that comes from the Russian government, just to be clear.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, let's talk about
the timing of all this, which you mentioned. It's June of 2016. At that point, what did we know about Russia's involvement in the election?
Well, we certainly now know that the Russian government had already been involved in a hack that stole a great deal of DNC emails. Those emails would become public just weeks later on the eve of the Democratic Convention. We, I should say, do not have any evidence that this damaging information that's being discussed in this meeting had anything to do with the hacked emails or the Russian government hack that we now know well about.
So is this clearly untoward, or is there a world in which this is perfectly all right?
Well, it certainly should be said that campaigns are always interested in research that might damage their opponent. It's the sort of bloodstream of American politics that this is part of the game. Mm-hmm. If you step back and think about it, you're talking about potentially accepting information from a foreign government whose interests have been not anywhere aligned with the United States in recent years. Mm-hmm. So this is not considered a friendly government, mm-hmm. certainly to the U.S. government.
What's collusion, though? Ignoring motivations, what would actually amount in this exchange to collusion?
Well, that's a good question, and it's not something we're trying to answer at the moment. I mean, I think we'd have to know a lot more about what became of this meeting, what information was actually mm-hmm. offered, whether anything was done with it. I think we want to be really careful to take it step by step and not sort of jump to any conclusions beyond what we, you know, certainly, as I said, some kind of interest on the part of the Trump campaign to get damaging information from Russians.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
On Monday night, a response from Donald Trump Jr.'s lawyer did not directly address the reporting that he was told the information was coming from the Russian government. In my view, the lawyer said of the Times reporting, it's much ado about nothing. But Democratic and Republican members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is investigating the president's ties to Russia, now say they want to hear from Donald Trump Jr. about what happened during the meeting with the Russian lawyer. In a tweet, the president's son said he was, quote, happy to work with the committee to pass on what I know. We'll be right back.
Hey, Daily listeners. Did you know you can listen to your favorite podcasts ad-free on Amazon Music? With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts, included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or visit amazon.com/thedailyadfree. That's amazon.com/thedailyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you think about the 2024 election, how do you feel?
Sickened.
Hey, y'all. Estead Herndon here, host of The Run-Up from The New York Times. And recently, I've been asking this question a lot.
I feel tired. I feel a little scared.
And I've been hearing the same sort of answer in reply.
We have an incompetent incumbent and a Republican that I'm not going to vote for. Yeah.
When voters look ahead to the 2024 presidential election, they feel apathy, dread, that it's just a mess. The Run-Up is your guide to that mess. Each week,
I am going to vote for the man with the most impeachments and the most indictments.
We'll talk to voters, elected officials.
I believe America can do for anyone what she's done for me.
And the candidates themselves, all to help you better understand this moment in American politics. The Run-Up is new every Thursday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
After more than 50 years of fighting and more than 200,000 lives lost, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC, has begun the process of disarming itself and returning to civilian life. All of this started last year when the FARC signed a peace deal with the Colombian government. And that's when my colleague Nicholas Casey had an idea.
I really wanted to go see them because this was going to be one of the last chances that, you know, people were going to be able to go document how they lived.
He asked a photographer, Frederico Rios, who knew the FARC, if he could visit the guerrilla group before its very last camps vanished from the jungles of Colombia.
And came back with a message saying that they were interested. So at that point, we basically got the names of two towns. One we could find on a map and another that we couldn't. this place Lejanías, which just means a place which is really far away. Of course, the first question people were asking is, why do you want to go there? We eventually did find some friendly motor taxi drivers who were interested in taking us. And we basically were on the back of the motorcycles for about 5 hours starting at dawn. Part of the problem is that so much of the Colombian countryside, because it's been at war for all of these years, they've never been able to pave. You know, government's never been able to go in and just like put the asphalt down in a lot of these places. So cars, regular taxis, just wouldn't be able to get through all of the mud and the dirt. We got to Lejanías, and we sat down in a, you could call it a coffee shop. It was basically somebody's home that was serving some food, and we got some breakfast, and we were tired. So I actually started to nod off and fell asleep. And I don't know how long it was after that, but Federico started to nudge me. And I remember sort of waking up and having a look out the door, and you could see these men and women in military fatigues and Kalashnikov rifles wandering outside looking for where we were. And we knew those were our hosts.
Greeting you as hosts do, I guess, with Kalashnikovs and fatigues.
And also with big smiles. They were very interested in us just as much as we were in them, because they don't see a lot of outsiders. You don't see a lot of foreigners when you're fighting a guerrilla battle.
So, Nick, just to step back, why were you visiting this camp when you did? Why was this a significant moment for the FARC?
It was a huge moment for the FARC and also for the entire country, because for the last 52 years, this group had been fighting an insurgent battle within Colombia. So this meant not just the end of a war, which had gone on for generations here in Colombia, but also it meant that what we were about to see was the end of one of the very last guerrilla groups in the jungle in Latin America, kind of a tradition which went back to the Cuban Revolution and Che Guevara.
From his stronghold in the wild Sierra Maestra Mountains, Cuba's Fidel Castro emerged triumphant after 2 years of guerrilla warfare against the Batista regime.
And one of the things that you were starting to see in Latin America during those times, you know, regionally, even in sort of other countries too, was that Marxist-Leninist ideology was starting to take root. Political groups, communist parties, even at the level of student unions, were beginning to talk about, could we apply some of these ideas to our country?
Nuestra lucha victoriosa trajo dos consecuencias.
And in the case of Colombia, you did have a small group of fighters that took up arms and decided this might be the way to change Colombia, not through entering the political system, but coming in from the outside, using weapons to take pieces of territory, and eventually seeing if one day there would be a way to take over the entire country.
La imagen por la cual vale la pena arriesgar la vida.
This is the end of Latin American guerrilla movements. The FARC was sort of like one of these like living fossils that had somehow managed to escape all the mass extinctions of the guerrilla movements all throughout Latin America over the years. And this place that we were going to go to was one of the last living camps. It was sort of like a time capsule that we were about to see.
Mandes lo que mandes, vamos a obedecer.
Mandes lo que mandes, vamos a obedecer.
So you walk into this camp, and there was about 200 fighters who were there, living in tents and hammocks. There's Che Guevara posters on the wall, the kind of thing that you might see in a college dorm room, but in dead earnestness, people sitting around reading books of communist theory, reading Marx and Lenin, classes on these philosophers. You'll see a guy who's sitting around with a guitar singing kind of folk songs about the revolution. And now they're sort of circled around in what often looks like could have been a summer camp somewhere, except for all the military fatigues and the grenades.
But the FARC is responsible for some some extraordinarily gruesome, serious acts of terror and crime.
Yeah, this was an ideological battle, but I think very soon into it, it just sort of spread beyond ideology and just into kind of fear and terror for a lot of people here. You know, in the countryside, the massacres, people would be carted off. And then years later, their remains may or may not be found in mass graves. And I think if you ask Colombians what they remember most about this conflict, it's often the kidnappings, because so many people either themselves were kidnapped or know someone who was kidnapped. And it, I think, really just affected the psyche of anyone who was here, especially during the 80s and the 90s, when for a lot of people it was hard just to walk the streets of Bogota because you didn't know if someone's going to snatch you.
And what are some examples of that?
There's examples everywhere. And you see, actually, a lot of the examples of some of the worst things that happened within the FARC from people who were FARC fighters. There's one young woman who I know whose name is Melida.
Fue muy largo el viaje, pero llegamos al campamento. Habían más muchachos de mi edad, de...
Who used to be a FARC fighter. I wrote a profile of her for the Times to kind of show this path that former FARC fighters are going to have to take now, that they're going back into regular life. And she told me her life story. She was kidnapped when she was 9 years old by FARC fighters. Basically, she was sitting on the floor of her grandparents' house when two fighters came in to her house and said that they had some stew for her in their canoe. And she joined them in the canoe, and 5 hours later, when they hadn't produced any lunch, she knew that she wasn't coming back. They took her deep into the forest, where she was brought to a small camp where they had brought a number of other children who they were bringing in to be child soldiers.
Primero lo dispararon al hermano y después a la muchacha.
She was taught before she was, you know, 12, how to make landmines, how to hide in trenches. And then once she got to 16 and went through puberty, one of the commanders started to take an interest in her and forced her into a relationship, raped her repeatedly until she was actually able to get out of the FARC when she went to visit her father one day back in her home, and her father called the police.
Como que no estaba como, no estaba de acuerdo.
For someone like her, who's spent basically her whole life in the FARC, I wonder what this transition from guerrilla life to civilian life has been like.
Yeah, I've been spending a lot of time in the demobilization camps where the FARC are now. They've left their camps in the jungle where they've been fighting and have all gone into places where they're disarming that are not in the jungle but close to towns and cities in many cases. They're kind of experimenting in what it's like to be a civilian. They're getting rid of their old military fatigues, putting on regular clothes. Slowly they were handing over their weapons to UN inspectors. And the government also provided them with construction materials to build little homes for themselves so they could kind of try out what it was like to live not in a hammock and not in a tent. This was kind of like a stepping stone to getting to what their life originally was going to be, so there wouldn't be quite so much of a culture shock. But fundamentally, the idea of going and sleeping on a bed, being in a town, trying to find a job where they would be someone's employee, it's like going to Mars for them or something.
We've been talking about the transition of FARC members, but I wonder what it's like for the wider community of kind of upstanding Colombians who have to absorb these people, because in some ways it feels like a jail has been opened and people have walked out from behind the bars and they're just entering the community again en masse. And I wonder if regular Colombians are alarmed and unhappy about that.
Yeah, and Michael, that's like the exact question which I think everybody is asking here in Colombia. The peace deal has been pretty controversial.
The final result goes against all polls and expectations. The peace agreement between the government and...
Late last year, they had a referendum on it, which actually failed.
...was rejected by Colombian voters by less than one percentage point.
Santos, the president, brought it to the people for a yes or no vote, something he expected was going to pass. And by a small margin, it failed. And the reason was, for a lot of people, they felt the FARC was getting off way too easy in this.
They are not willing to forgive a terrorist group, as they call the FARC, that has killed people, that has raped women.
And I think there is a sense, if you ask a lot of Colombians, of nervousness and almost sometimes of a sense that peace was being traded for justice, that people didn't get justice here, but they did get an end to the war. The leader of the FARC wants to form a political party, and I think, you know, many of the commanders want to get involved. Are they going to have success? I'm not sure. I've talked to a lot of people in the countryside, and I'm not sure how much they ever actually believed in the FARC as much as they had to believe in the people that had the weapons. The big question is, if you don't have rifles, are people still going to support you? And are they going to vote for you? The idea for many Colombians of seeing FARC commanders potentially in their Congress, for many is just something they can't imagine. And yet it's part of what is seen as the reconciliation process here. You will begin to see FARC fighters, people who used to be in military fatigues and planting mines near villages, going in to try to be the butcher there or the man sort of running the garage to fix cars. And that's going to be a hard sight for a lot of Colombians. And there's going to be a lot of FARC fighters who probably won't even say that they were involved in the guerrilla fighting and won't talk a lot about their past. But fundamentally, I think that's part of what happens in post-Civil War societies when they're just trying to get past those years and trying to reconcile everything that happened. People have to be able to kind of live as neighbors together. It's not an easy process.
Nick, after 5 decades of fighting, why would this rebel group ever lay down arms? Did it achieve its goals in the end?
It's clear they didn't achieve any of their goals. This is not a communist society right now. They will have a small political organization, but not much chance of actually running this country. I think in a lot of ways, the FARC was getting tired. I think there was an understanding among everyone that this war had done a lot of damage to this country. But I think most importantly, a lot of the leadership of the FARC, who was kind of the baby boomer generation, people born in the 1940s and early 1950s, were starting to get old. They were living in the jungle every day, and I don't think this lifestyle was something that they wanted to live forever in. And many were looking for a way to retire in some ways. This was, in a way, an easy out. They had a president of Colombia who was really interested in ending this war and was actually willing to offer them a deal where almost everyone, from rank and file fighters to most of the leadership, was not going to have to face any jail time. So I think within the FARC, although they wouldn't quite admit this, there was an understanding that they weren't going to win, but they needed to look for an off-ramp to this war.
Nick, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
With Schwab Investing Themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.